wasn't ready yet.
Aw.
Hello. You always laugh.
Because I anticipate.
Because I stare. I think we stare at each other. I think it's pretty safe to say that we actually stare at each other.
Yeah.
The whole time we record this podcast. Called.
Entire time.
Map to the Stars.
And funny enough.
We don't blink. We don't blink once.
There have been times where I haven't been looking at you and you've stopped because you're like, you're not paying attention.
What's that meme that we saw? Like, put it on my gravestone.
I don't know.
Died from not enough attention. Remember that thing we saw?
Sounds like me.
Put it on my
gravestone. Where did we see that?
I don't know.
Oh, don't worry about it.
Welcome to Map to the Stars, the podcast that looks to the stars abroad in Hollywood and above in the night sky.
Governor. Night sky.
My name's Jeremy.
I'm Michelle.
And we are your filmy chartographers. We've dived deep.
We dive deep.
I think you said dive twice.
That's the point.
I haven't seen that movie since the day it came out, I think. We dive deep and dodge into the night sky or whatever, and then we talk about directors and their charts and their filmographies. We look at astrology and we look at filmography. And today we have an explosive director, an outstanding,
chaotic,
exceptional, chaotic, and we're talking about Kathryn Bigelow on today's episode.
Huzzah.
The energy, come on.
I know. My goodness. Her movies are a lot to process for a timid gal like myself.
But I want. Yeah, but in interviews.
Oh, she's like a puppy dog. She ages backwards.
I don't know if she's a dainty flower. I don't know if she's Benjamin Button.
She looks amazing.
She's ageless. I don't know if she ages backwards. I don't know if that's right.
Ageless.
She doesn't look like a.
We're talking about Kathryn Bigelow. What the heck?
Look, you can't throw a Benjamin Button at me and, you know, it throws me for a loop.
Why?
Because it doesn't happen. And you know how many people, I swear I've read a lot about how people think Benjamin Button is a real condition.
Do you know Jeremy bought Benjamin Button, not the Criterion Edition, from a discount bin, I think at a Walmart?
Do you want to hear a story? Jeremy did buy the Criterion Collection version of it on DVD. So.
Not on Blu-ray.
Big omitted. There you go. Not on Blu-ray.
It's Criterion, not on Blu-ray.
It was a $4. What'd you say? The trash bin?
No, the discount bin.
It wasn't the discount bin. It was a Value Village.
Oh. I thought, guess Walmart wouldn't make sense. Value Village.
What am I going to Walmart for? In Red Deer, Alberta. In Red Deer, Alberta, I picked up Benjamin Button. DVD, Criterion Collection. It is still yet to be opened. I hope.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, I have.
Oh, okay.
I've seen every Fincher, as I have every Bigelow movie.
Yeah, you have.
Yeah.
Congrats.
Can you name them all? We are going to talk about
Kathryn Bigelow movies?
We're going to talk about two on this episode, but featured in the trailer that we would have posted just recently.
Mm-hmm.
Can you name? I
can't name all of them, but I can name some of them. Because I thought Kathryn Bigelow won the Oscar for Zero Dark Thirty, which she did not. So that's one of them.
She did
Hurt Locker is another one. Strange Days, which we are talking about today. Crazy movie. I needed to take a nap afterwards. Point Break. Seen it twice now. Love it more the second time. After that, Detroit, because you had strong feelings about it. And that is all I can name.
And a bit of a motif.
Oh, and the one with Jamie. You got to take that one.
So you named four movies or five? You named five movies.
One, two, three, four, five. Missing the one with Jamie Lee Curtis.
So the filmography in chronological order, feature length releases would be The Loveless, which is Willem Dafoe's first theatrical theatrical debut.
That's awesome.
There's only one first debut, so I guess that's a... I'm wasting my breath here saying that. Theatrical debut from Willem Dafoe. You have Near Dark, which is five years later. And again, another motif. I didn't even say the first motif. The first motif of strong feelings. Everyone has strong feelings about every single one of her movies. She has, except for the ones in the middle, which I will get to. She is probably the most controversial director that we will discuss, I think, ever. Yeah, she's absolutely polarizing. I would say that Point Break, maybe not so. That is a bit, that is probably her... not her magnum opus or her masterpiece. I think Hurt Locker, The Hurt Locker is probably her best movie, but everyone's favorite's got to be Point Break. It's quite an easy, fun, and still very dynamic, interesting,
absolutely,
and worthy of study movie and watch and 100%. Creation and film.
Couldn't agree more.
But she has controversy really surrounding her, and she's made a name for herself with that probably since Hurt Locker. Hurt Locker was big, and she keeps taking up these war and issue movies for sure. Detroit is an issue movie, and Zero Dark Thirty is, I want to say playing fast and loose, but it definitely isn't playing fast and loose with that. But everyone, if you like look it up on YouTube, you could just see like social justice warrior propaganda, Detroit and all that, because it's always, you know, against cops. Mm-hmm. And Zero Dark Thirty has no sort of leaning. And a lot of people think that she makes apolitical movies and that she should take a harder stance. And then those on the right think that it's all a bunch of propaganda because it's so like, because the general left film critics, most film critics are left, they're going to react to the films as violent but clearly disturbing, because look at the images on screen. Aren't they just obviously the most disturbing thing you've ever seen in your life? So ambiguous, which must mean it. Anyway.
She just makes movies that are very difficult to watch.
But she's a difficult director.
You definitely stopped at the second movie in the list. So why don't you pick it up where you left off?
And another motif, because there's 5-year difference, I believe, maybe a 4-year difference between The Loveless and Near Dark. She has trouble making and financing these movies. And for a long time, she held the record for the largest budget given to a female director. It just wasn't happening. One of few names in Hollywood for female directors. And up until 2017, a whole 15 years later, from all these movies that I'm not mentioning, Wonder Woman from Patty Jenkins had the largest budget for a female-directed movie, which is now certainly changing. Chloe Zhao did The Eternals, right? After Nomadland, and that would have probably been more expensive than Wonder Woman.
Big budget.
Yeah.
Totally.
All her films are The Loveless, Near Dark, and then it goes Blue Steel, which is the Jamie Lee Curtis.
There you go.
Cop drama, female cop, Point Break, Strange Days. She makes The Weight of Water, K-19, The Widowmaker, two water-fueled movies that no one sees. Kind of destroys her career, hiccups it after Strange Days. She makes The Hurt Locker, which won her Best Picture, Best Directing, first woman to win an Oscar.
Ever.
We're kind of jumping all around the bio, but we'll get to it in a more succinct way. And then Zero Dark Thirty and Detroit. Detroit was where we left off. The world's left off with Bigelow, and right now, I don't think anyone really knows what she's going to make. So, bated breath, because, hey, she's great.
She sure is.
Why don't we get into the bio?
Catherine Bigelow was born on November 27th, 1951 at 7:19 a.m. in San Carlos, California. Wikipedia says she was born on November 28th, and I was thrown off for a little bit, but I think there is strong evidence supporting the fact that she was born on the 27th. I think Wikipedia is the only site that potentially misdates it. However, if this whole episode is off, I deeply apologize. However, one source says, birth time accuracy is excellent. So, like, very strong likelihood she was born at 7:19 a.m. So, we'll leave it there. That means that her sun is in Sagittarius along with her ascendant and Mercury. So, lots of Sagittarius action. Her moon is in Scorpio, and she has 4 planets in Libra. So I guess 2 mini stelliums in that sense. In Libra, we have Venus in its domicile, Mars, Saturn, and Neptune. With Venus in Libra, obviously, we're gushing already. She's a true master of her craft with a soft spot for earnest romance, as seen as a relatively central theme in her movies. I think in Point Break, amongst all of the like over-the-topness, you had mentioned that the kind of romance was the one thing that's probably very earnest and truthful, which I agree with.
Yeah, it feels like a grounded romance as opposed to the heightened bromance between, Johnny Utah, Keanu, and Patrick Swayze, Bodhi.
Totally.
And hopefully you've seen Point Break. Spoilers.
Well, ahead, yeah, please.
And Strange Days.
Please go ahead.
We'll summarize these movies soon, but we're, you know,
absolutely,
we always assume you see these movies. So.
And with something like Point Break, where it's skydiving and surfing and action and cops. It's like, despite what you might think, taking her films at face value, her movies are also infused with this very human element of love and connection, whether between lovers or bros or pals, whatever, in a way that's not as satirical as some of the other like themes or tropes in her movies.
No, but it is substantive and then adds to the, hopefully adds to the tension because you care for the characters.
Totally.
But in an interview with Film Comment around the time of Strange Days, you know, she talks about momentum a lot and the design of her movies and that you need to have breaks in between all the action or else, you know, the viewer is going to be tired of it. So you need those, you know, Strange Days, maybe too many breaks.
Well, that's
a little bit too long.
Okay. Well, I thought I had the opposite problem where I was tired by the end of it because it was a lot. Anyway, we'll get to that.
And by the end of Point Break, you want to skydive.
I want to skydive and surf.
And Strange Days, just want a nap.
Just one up. So in the whole sign house system, Bigelow's Libra stellium is in the 11th house. Bigelow has said that the secret to directing is collaborating, which I think speaks well to the artistically driven Libra, which includes Venus, housing numerous planets in the house of collaboration. James Cameron, obviously her primary collaborator post-marriage, who worked on like, I think every one of her movies up to a certain point.
Up to Strange Days.
In the Placidus system, on the other hand, giving both here, because I think it adds an interesting amount of context, that stellium is in the 10th house, speaking more to the artistic nature of her career as a whole, as the 10th house governs career and, you know, public status or public image. But I'll dig into that a bit more later. The chart ruler, or the ruler of the ascendant, Jupiter is in Aries, Uranus is in Cancer, Pluto is in Leo, Chiron in Capricorn, and the nodes are in Pisces and Virgo. This will be no surprise given the content of her work, like chaos. But Bigelow's chart contains some heavy
energy.
Male
I don't
energy.
Know if it's chaos.
There's
you
some
can always
chaos.
Follow the action, I think. The geography. She talks about geography
being
really
important.
Oh my God,
no, no, no. Like the opening scene of Strange Days where it's just like the POV shot for like 5 minutes and it's just like... It's like you're watching like a cop cam. Anyway, so her chart.
That's exactly it.
That's exactly it. Her chart contains some heavy male energy with 9 out of the 11 planets plus the ascendant being in male signs, 2 in female signs. As an easy point to pick out, Bigelow's movies are working with genres and topics that are very male-oriented as a start. So as a female director, she's interestingly very divorced publicly from her gender in a very male-dominated industry, and as the first woman to win the Academy Award, as we mentioned, for Best Director, which she did in 2010, not for Zero Dark Thirty, but for The Hurt Locker.
You're outing yourself here. I didn't say anything.
Oh, goodness. I think it's because I like that movie better. But most of the screenplays she chooses follow...
You liked Zero Dark Thirty better?
I think so. Okay, more on that later.
We're going to need a part two for
sure,
that.
Sure, sure, sure.
What?
Okay. More on that later. Most of the screenplays she chooses follow male leads.
Chris Pratt? Wait, he's not really in. He sucks.
These male leads, I guess up to a certain point, you know, taking out Jessica Chastain as a very strong female lead in that
movie. We're just
talking
these two movies, yeah.
Just these two movies.
Point Break, Strange Days.
The males engage in the traditional realms of masculinity seen throughout film history, like crime, war, and other adrenaline-soaked wet and wild, like literally, like water. and high stakes.
I thought she said it has more fire signs than water. Now you're confusing me.
But again, it's that energy. On the other hand, in flipping gender expectations, her female characters can be quite androgynous. So from Tyler, played by Lori Petty in Point Break with short cropped hair, who's easily mistakable for Keanu Reeves' Johnny Utah with the right angle. And then looking at Angela Bassett as Mace, who's less emotional and more muscular, strong and badass than any other character in Strange Days, specifically when staged next to her counterpart, Lenny, who is played by the wonderful Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah, Lenny with his, you know, long hair, lean, kind of.
Gets punched around a lot.
Well, he is certainly in distress and needs saving.
Absolutely.
Most of the time. Mace, which... I think is a really smart name, and I, you know, if I were writing an essay about all this, it'd be like, what's in a name between Bodhi, and Johnny Utah, yep, and Lenny Nero, which has its own connotations of like the Roman emperor, or is it Greek emperor?
More on that later. Nero. I have to look that up.
Tagline. Buy merch at mapstars.com. More on that later. And then the back has nothing because we never follow up.
Absolutely not.
But then mace is, you know, what's the one kind of weapon generic to women who try to, you know,
mace
to protect themselves, right? Absolutely. You know what I mean?
She uses it in the movie.
Interesting. I know. It's so interesting.
Love it. Fire and air share near equal dominance, which I think makes sense because, like, again, the energy and the chaos of it all. Contained chaos.
More on that later.
Contained chaos. with none of Bigelow's planets falling into an earth sign and only two in water sign. So very little water, very little earth. Beyond literal fire in many of her movies, which is obvious, Bigelow's films are incredibly action-packed. Fast pace, you need that downtime. They're chaotic, complementing her strong fire energy. But they're also incredibly intelligent, investigative, and self-reflexive, borrowing from those air significations. She didn't choose to have Patrick Swayze jump out of a plane and pull off death-defying stunts because it looks cool. It does look very cool, and I know Patty had a really great time pulling off all those stunts.
We're calling him
Patty. He was hooked. That's my cute pet name. But the purpose of Bodhi's journey, who's Patrick Swayze's character, is to tell us what people, specifically men, are searching for spiritually and emotionally when they commit such acts of jumping out of planes and,
yeah,
and surfing deathly waves.
Right. Or maybe like what men convince themselves of in order to justify their dumb macho man, you know, jerk off energy that they wish to indulge in. It's
totally.
It's pseudo. Like the, when Bodhi's kind of delivering it, remember he's saving the group from what they want to
mm-hmm,
they want to jump ship,
totally,
right? Because they've been found out by Johnny at this, mm-hmm, point in the plot, and then he kind of reveals his philosophy. But really, are you buying it? You know, they buy it,
but as a viewer,
you know, you kind of at that point you're kind of meant to turn on Bodhi there.
Well,
so,
it's so easy, right, to see through at that point for sure.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll mention for now is that the cardinal quadruplicity is heavily dominant with lots of Libra, Aries, and Cancer. Bigelow is, of course, in many ways the first of her kind, both in terms of the movies she makes and in terms of her accomplishments in the film industry.
Right. Yeah. Besides being the first woman to win for Best Directing at the 2010 Oscars, as we've said, her 2002 Cold War submarine drama, K-19, The Widowmaker, which is edited by Walter Murch. Fun fact.
Ooh, biggie.
Yeah, biggie. Well, and you were talking about collaboration, but, you know, forget Jimmy C. You know, he's certainly involved, but she works with the same cinematographers and editors, mm-hmm, throughout this kind of period. I think from Blue Steel to Strange Days, when she's more prolific in her work, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as we were saying, she had the largest budget female directed for that submarine movie. Now, it bombed, and it unfortunately, like Strange Days, created this pattern of her just not having luck with her movies. I think Strange Days is great. I understand how it could bomb. You know, maybe a lot of people want a nap. It's a difficult movie, sure. But
around the mid-90s,
there are stranger movies, surely, that are more well-known that didn't really bomb. I can't think of any right now. But
no.
But I think that something like K-19, yeah, that was always going to bomb. That's a bad movie, but
yeah.
But Liam Neeson and Harrison Ford are in it, so you would think so. Anyway, you know, sidestepping the attention, you know, and us focusing solely on the gender and everything like that, she also fostered groundbreaking camera technology, specifically with the movies we're discussing, Point Break and Strange Days, manipulating Steadicam rigs to better suit her kinetic, highly controlled chaos, as you say, and elaborate action set pieces. You know, you can look to the chase sequence in Point Break, and, you know, that's after the gas station flamethrower scene.
Yep.
And the intro to Strange Days, aforementioned, mm-hmm, from Michelle, which is the POV, prescient. I mean, the whole movie's prescient about how we interact with how our devices and technological devices, if you will, you know, manipulate our memories,
mm-hmm,
that we can recreate memories and relive them constantly. It's the same idea of someone filming a concert and going home and watching that concert is the same that Lenny Nero was filming his sex with his ex-boo, Juliette Lewis, Faith, and then rewatching it after, you know. And we can think of even more heinous and insidious versions of that, let's say, of modern couples. And if they break up, and maybe they have their own record that one of them can go back to as well. So, you know, as Mace, Angela Bassett in the film says, you know, memories are meant to fade. They're built that way. And this technology isn't. And Squid, and I can't remember what Squid means in the movie, but it's just this technology that basically records what you see. And you can feel it and all that kind of stuff. And there's like the sweetest moment in the film is when Lenny gives to this guy that like collects packages at a club. He's a paraplegic. He doesn't have any legs. Gives him a memory specially designed for him where he's running and a woman notices him. And it's sweet. It's like a nice memory. And he's like, he wants to cry or something like that. It's nice. That's not a nap worthy moment, you know?
No, it's not that it's nap worthy. It's not that it's, I guess nap implies like boring, but it's just, it's exhausting. It's really, it's not holding anything back. It's brutal. It's gruesome. It's.
Yeah. But I mean, how do you feel after scrolling, right? Someone,
Do
you know what I mean? Like going through the doom scrolling.
Yep.
It certainly is that, you know, it reflects the LA riots at the time. Bigelow famously talks about how she went down after the LA riots, post the Rodney King beatings and all the police brutality happening in LA in the early 90s. And that directly influenced a lot of the visuals in the movie, the cinematography, how it felt. You know, the sun hardly shines in this movie. It takes place over 24 hours or less. There's like a couple scenes of sunshine, but they're mostly shrouded in darkness.
Totally.
And it seems that, you know, definitely Y2K, the end of the world's coming. So, yeah, I don't know. Like, what did you think about the technology? Did you think that it was dated or did you think that it did really reflect what it's like to live with a computer in your pocket, you know, hooked up to your eyes, and that creates its own, the mediated reality of experiencing other people's lives. Again, concert, I think concert footage filmed from someone's POV perspective, and we're going to more shows and we see a lot of people filming stuff. And so, you know, I don't know, what was that like for you? I thought it was cool and a lot of people talk about it. That's mostly what people talk about it now, now that it's just 25 years old.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah, I think that's my thing with sci-fi sometimes, specifically when it's like very dark sci-fi, like Strange Days is, where it's not that I find it dated at all. It's the opposite. I have a hard time with these movies sometimes because it's very unsettling, where it's like these movies are foretelling certain things and you wonder how somebody could ever think that shit up. They're ominous. It's like gloomy. It like puts you in a... an interesting place where you're seeing like the present and the future reflected from something that was made 25 years ago, which I think is so fascinating. And I don't understand how it's done and how people pull that off. But yeah, mixed feelings.
Even now, like The Matrix too, you know, running on the Keanu train in the 90s, The Matrix really predicted a lot of elements about the internet and identity and persona and avatars, you know, the avatars of like who Neo versus, you know, John Anderson, right? And that's why the new movie's so good too, and it plays with all that kind of idea. But anyway, more on that later.
More on that.
Cool. I think you got a little bit more with the analysis and the astrology.
Love it.
Yeah.
To start with a quote from Bigelow herself, she says, "I've spent a fair amount of time thinking about what my aptitude is. And I really think it's to explore and push the medium, which is film. It's not about breaking gender roles or gender traditions." Despite her intentions, I think it's hard to divorce conversations about Bigelow's films from her masterful manipulation and interpretation of genre. Genres most typically utilized by men, like action for Point Break, sci-fi noir for Strange Days. However, I think her point is that she's not making the cinematic choices she does strictly for the sake of shaking up the movie industry's depictions of male cops.
Or female cops in Blue Steel, you know.
Which I have not seen. Just as a straightforward example. Rather, she's unpacking why things are the way they are. Why are men attracted, maybe even addicted, to death-defying acts? As pointed out in the opening quote to The Hurt Locker, where it says, "War is a drug." Why do cops commit heinous crimes like in Strange Days or Detroit?
And Blue Steel talks about that too. And you know, police are pretty prevalent throughout all of it. So, yeah.
While her use of tropes are operating in entirely different ways, pushing more subtly towards satire in Point Break to something that is far darker and no fun at all and tiring in Strange Days, both are still serving as explorations into violence, male action, gender politics, spirituality, amongst many, many other things. In past episodes, I primarily focused on individuals' charts using the Placidus house system. And maybe for Bob Fosse, I mentioned points for both Placidus and Whole Sign. I'd also like to take a look at both today. Remember that Bigelow has a Libra stellium containing Venus, Mars, Saturn, and Neptune. In the Placidus system, as I mentioned earlier, all of those planets fall into the 10th house. In the Whole Sign system, all of those planets fall into the 11th. As Saturn and Mars are both present in Libra, the two malefics' energies are both competing against and collaborating with each other. So Saturn is the slow-moving significator of rules, traditions, and frameworks, or the pre-established genres and rules that Bigelow is operating within. Hot and fiery Mars, who is the malefic that's contrary to the sect, as Bigelow's chart is a day chart and Mars finds its home and comfort during the night, Mars is the planet with the potential to do the most harm in Bigelow's chart as a whole. In consideration with Saturn, Mars is the one that's seeking to break through the pre-established norms, traditions, and rules of the action or sci-fi genre, bringing in something entirely new and potentially destructive. In Libra, this is Bigelow's masterful act of pushing the medium to its breaking point rather than existing comfortably within it. Through stretching these formations and frameworks of genres and filmmaking as a whole, Bigelow has gained her identity as someone who transcends the blockbuster action flick as a true auteur, but it's also what has gained her a lot of public criticism in regards to her films.
Or I think that maybe she's become an auteur because of her unique voice and vision while working in the, you know, traditional blockbuster paradigm and format. She often talks about how she loves sneaking in art film ideas into the multiplex paradigm. Yeah, keep using paradigm, but
I've also seen enough commenting on how she kind of straddles both worlds and that she is really popular in the mainstream in certain ways. Her films more recently have been successful. I mean, minus Detroit, potentially. Hurt Locker.
It still made money. It still definitely made money.
Still made money where she chose to
She's fine since Hurt Locker.
Totally.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah, but she's commercially successful and she's also found more of like a cult status in other ways with some of her past work.
Oh, all of her past works cult status.
Love it.
Strange Days, I would say Point Break is now a cult movie, even though it was quite successful, but it's got its like fervent, you know, fans, and it's the same with Near Dark as well. I would say that, yeah, she has a bizarre cross-section between popular success since Hurt Locker, which again, difficult movie. Quite an art film.
Yep.
And more of an essay. Even though it's melodramatic and it certainly has a lot of conventions and ideologies that are consistent with a lot of other war films, certainly at the time, it's not American Sniper. It's not that, right? It's not even, again, exploration into like what drives these men.
Totally.
And when you can't connect to it, it's somehow still so fascinating. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like not only are
they
actually on the other side of the earth, like mentally, they're just like, you couldn't be farther away from, you know.
Because it's like an interesting like human study.
Yeah, it's and that's the human element.
Totally.
Even if these are most of her protagonists are not sympathetic.
Mm-mm.
You know, it took you a while to warm up to Lenny.
Oh, even though you love Ralph Fiennes. Of the movie, yeah.
You know, and probably a lot of people would still think that Lenny's
feeling pretty
an idiot,
chilly, yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
Pretty chilly?
Warmed up.
All right.
To push that point prior about, you know, Saturn, Mars's relationship with tradition and structure versus breaking out of that, the placements in Libra in Bigelow's chart are in opposition to Jupiter in Aries, the Saturn and Mars conflict potentially causing tension between her commercial and creative success, as Jupiter also falls within the fifth house in the Whole Sign system, which governs creativity. Both 10th and 11th house significations for this cluster of planets in Libra works well, with that tension between Saturn and Mars either impacting her 10th house of career and her work within the film industry, enter big Libra energy as it is an artistic and creative medium, or the 11th as exemplifying a community of pre-established norms and expectations, which is drawing on work inspired by, you know, directors, other creators that came before her to establish those genres. And what is all of this tension doing? It's pushing the viewer towards self-reflection by commenting on our own viewing habits, our beliefs about gender politics and norms, love, violence, race, and politics, all of the things I said before. To call back to the quote I gave at the beginning of this section where Bigelow says, I've spent a fair amount of time thinking about what my aptitude is, and I really think it's to explore and push the medium. Bigelow's Sun, Rising, and Mercury are all in Sagittarius in the first house in the whole sign system, as Sun is in the 12th in Placidus. Sagittarius is definitely the sign to explore new perspectives and stretch things in a very philosophical and intelligent way. With the Sun here, it makes sense that Bigelow feels as if it's her purpose almost, achieved through the medium of film, a language that can be very mercurial. Mercurial, it's a hard word to say. Since all of this is also happening in the first house, not only is it closely related to Bigelow's sense of self, but it can also play into one's sense of self in general, the viewer's sense of self. How Bigelow's use of film reflects us back onto ourselves with a very critical lens. So, enough rambling.
Well, that guy, I can kind of really
jump
dig
in there.
Into that. So,
love
yeah,
it.
Specifically with the sense of self and reflecting back ideas, there is a dialogue that happens, and it's a two-way highway between Bigelow and the viewer, and she understands that. And we have been we're remiss to kind of not really talk about this yet, but she comes from an art school background. She grew up, she was born just a bit outside of San Francisco, went to school there, and primarily in visual arts. And she talks about in this same, which seems like a bigger article anyway, because it's been referenced in a lot of scholarly journals that I was reading, this film comment, Strange Days era interview, that, when she was 14, she was blowing up these details from the master painters and recreating them. And so
wow.
The recreation of the paintings themselves, already beginning to understand that, like looking at the smaller details. And she's a very detail-oriented, very controlling director. And an example of this is that there is a shot, the sort of overhead shot of Keanu and Lori Petty in bed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's the black sheets. And
oh,
it's very painterly, yeah. And he's kind of stroking her arm,
and she's like draped across him.
Well, and it looks very staged, mm-hmm. and I'm sure it is manipulated in that way. But you know, she talks about, you know, they talk about obviously that if film is a canvas, moving art that you're going to create, you know, lighting is your brush, and but she even talks about that the original direction in that scene in the first place, and anything like that, because the interviewer asks, you know, did you stage them like that? Did you sculpt your actors like that? And she goes, no, I always just, when we're first getting into a scene, I want to see how they play into it naturalistically. And then I sort of fit it and to make sure that it works with everything else, make sure that it's consistent with their character and that, you know, we're going and it's got a good flow and as in what you do as a director. But it's not like she goes in and is like, I need this immediately. So
yeah,
that's
right.
Where I kind of keep saying, you know, the controlling, the chaos or whatever. Yes and no, because it's not obviously chaos, meaning that like, you know, but
fires, explosions.
Yeah. And,
gas
and chaos might seem like, I don't know, a Transformers movie or something that it seems
right.
Just a little all over the place, you know, but it's, you know, this is going to sound terrible, but it's closer to a Tarantino or something, even though I hate the guy, but or just think of anyone else. Edgar Wright. Edgar Wright's a much better mm-hmm. example of like action and great camera work. And what can seem like a million things going on at once in a scene, but obviously is, you know, look, movie magic, okay?
Absolutely.
She's very well-versed in movie magic, but language is so important to that. So studying in San Francisco as a visual artist, got the opportunity from her professor to then go to New York, and she was the understudy of, was in Andrew Saris's class, and he developed the auteur theory, if we're dropping that. Andrew Saris wrote the book on auteur theory in the 60s and 70s. She
incredible.
Was, you know, some of her peers, as in sort of like her eldest peers, Susan Sontag, okay? Milos Forman, got to work with Milos Forman, one of the most incredible directors of all time. Haven't seen enough from him. But she was surrounded by and certainly studied in semiotics and language and constructionism and deconstructionism, constructivism. I haven't been to school in a while, but anyway, schools of thought.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then that's exactly it. She liked to smuggle in art film ideas, art ideas, semiotics, building all into that. She's obsessed with the idea of the sculpted, mediated image, but then interestingly wants to recreate that as closely as possible. Look to a lot of Strange Days with the POV shots.
Right.
You know, you didn't have a lot of that in film. It was certainly becoming much more prevalent. But what is she basing this off of? Doom? Had Doom come out yet? That's the earliest FPS, essentially. Like, and you think of like what the old Doom looks like, you know?
We gotta look into this.
Michelle's looking at me like I got worms coming out of my ears. But just think of like, you know, maybe GTA 5's first person view. That would have been, it would have came out around, you know, 2015, whatever, you know, less than 10 years ago, you had something maybe close to resembling Strange Days where you can go on a homicide killing spree in first person view where you're driving and you're going to the strip club and you're shooting a bunch of people and you're robbing. You're robbing a grocery store or something like, right? Which is actually quite tame compared to what you see in Strange Days. Unfortunately, but
oh yeah.
Really, it's so amazing that to kind of dream that up and bring it and make that alive into something that probably felt familiar at the time. That probably felt like, well, this is what a POV would be like,
right?
A point of view, a first person point of view, and to recreate that, to move forward and build new camera technology, new rigs to do that, really speaks to in the cinematography itself, in the camera technology, in the camera work, in the storytelling, in our directing, everything. You know, she is working to push the medium forward, but she's doing that in favor of this idea of creating something as close to reality as possible. And that's so interesting because the mediated image itself that she talks about, again, we can kind of get heady with this because she's getting heady with this herself as a semiotician and working within that. How are viewers negotiating with and interpreting the image? We understand Keanu Reeves as stoner. So we don't, do we buy him as an FBI agent? Well, yeah, we do. But then he's also going undercover as a surfer. It's perfect casting. Anyone who says that Keanu Reeves can be acting or he's, you know, now we get the Renaissance and the John Wick movies really prove himself. No, he was already doing this stuff. He's already funny in Bill and Ted as Ted.
Yep.
He's already quite apt and has the athletic prowess and has like the shallow emotional depth necessary for a person named Johnny Utah.
Yeah.
Like, that's absolutely exactly it. He's telling you, he's like, well, my parents told me everything that I should be doing, and then I just went along with it. But then I hurt my knee, and now I want to be, like, yeah, he's an idiot. Like, and it's like, well, if he sounds like an idiot, he's an idiot. Yeah, like, that works with it. It's great casting. You know, it's layered, and it's working on so many levels. Look, when you're casting Willem Dafoe in his first movie, like, she's got an eye, that kind of thing. You know, Ralph Fiennes, and it's so working towards really, really layered, nuanced movies. What are your thoughts? And then I'll go on my quick, you know, formulated opinions and thoughts and wrap it up.
Yeah, all I'd say is that I think, you know, she's making films for the informed viewer. And I say that because I think until recently, I haven't been as critical as I am now, or as you are in terms of how I watch movies and why I watch movies. So Point Break, the first time we watched it, I think through dissecting the purpose of why Johnny Utah is the way he is, or the purpose of these male relationships, or just why Bigelow might have made the choices she did in that film, it just makes you appreciate it so much more, because I think her movies are layered enough that for Point Break, at face value, you take it as a really, like, not to say chaotic again, but a really high-energy, like, action movie.
But it's also,
like,
very silly,
it's
right?
Silly, it's funny.
But it also has an image of someone wearing a Ronald Reagan mask burning a gas station. Like,
right.
That's loaded. That's a loaded gun, you know?
Totally. So it's easy to write it off. It's easy to write it off as a silly action flick.
But she wants it to work like that, too, because that's the part of the filmmaking. And she does talk about it. She wants to smuggle it in, like, she says that there is an elitism, obviously, to the art world.
Absolutely.
That you need to have, there is a prerequisite involved in understanding a lot of that. But with movies, you don't have to. And she wants to do that. So she's making them for any viewer, honestly. And if you can be informed about it, then that's even better. And you're gaining everything. And she'd probably appreciate that. But I think that she is making movies for whoever wants to see them.
I think,
you know?
Yeah.
And she knows that you're going to, and the thing is, she knows you're going to bring whatever you're going to bring. And for Strange Days and maybe something like Zero Dark Thirty, you got to bring a lot more to the table. And she is asking more from the viewer, I would say. In Point Break, she isn't.
Well, I guess what I would say is hearing other people's opinions, again, on Point Break specifically, because I've seen it twice versus Strange Days, where I don't know anyone else who's watched it, but the two of us, is I think you get more out of it and you enjoy it more the more you dig into it. I have a newfound appreciation for it and enjoyment of that movie after digging into it more than if I had just watched it and said, okay, that's great. And I think the same can be said for Strange Days, where if you don't have that context, it might be a little more of a difficult watch. And you're just like, this is just brutal and tough. And I need some downtime from it. But again, when you dig into its origins, what it's influenced by, again, why she's doing things the way she is, you just get a different experience out of it, which is really fun. It's like what's something that changes every time you see it?
What's something that changes every single time you see it?
Don't worry about it. That was a silly thing to ask.
Jerry's girlfriend with the lighting, the face.
Yeah, right? That's okay. I leave it there. Perfect.
Maybe that's aging backwards. Maybe we can right the wrong from before. All right. So your takeaway is movies are good. Watch them intently.
Movies are great. Watch them intently.
Cool.
Yeah.
I think Bigelow would probably agree.
Get off your
phone
while you're watching it.
Well, talk about mediated experiences.
There you go. We're
discussing. Segway. Anyway, so for as a bit of a wrap up into, you know, talking about these movies, near the end of Point Break's first act, as Johnny Utah attends a party hosted by Bodhi and his tight-knit surfer clique, the crew takes a small respite from the antics inside the beach house to reflect on each member's experiential transcendence when surfing. Utah's romantic interest, surely plot dependent, and really just she kind of becomes perfunctory to the plot and needs to be saved, and that's unfortunate. But Tyler provides a winking foil to the bro dude heavy fireside chatter. She says big wave ridings for macho assholes with a death wish. She inevitably leaves the chat with an eye rolling. There's too much testosterone here.
There sure is.
Here being a male-oriented action movie, which is to say a traditional Hollywood action movie. Throughout the film, Tyler must carry the film's whole meta-satirical weight on her shoulders. In layman's terms, she cuts through the bullshit. Whatever pseudo-psychology and philosophy Bodhi dreams up for his equally thrilling surfing and robbing pastimes, like freeing the plebs stuck in their metal coffins, quote-unquote, on the highway during their commute to work, you know, showing them how to be alive, that the human spirit is alive. He says all that kind of stuff, as we were saying, when he's trying to rally the troops again to pull off one more job, and, mm-hmm. and he knows exactly what to do with Johnny, which works for a while, I guess. Bodhi is still, after all of this, Bodhi is still a near-perfect movie male archetype, even as he's trying to kind of probably get away from that. He's not like all the other guys. He has depth to it. Well, he's handsome, and he's also equally psychopathic.
Oh, my God. There are enough shots with him. Half clothed with his abs all out and about that. Yeah. You're going to look at him and be like, he's the perfect male. That's just my opinion.
That's just, yeah. So he's willing to sacrifice everything and anyone for the ultimate rush, invariably leading to his downfall as he pushes his luck too far past the breaking point when he attempts to rob the safe at his final bank robbery. Now, again, he sacrifices the boys. He doesn't necessarily get shot. He goes unscathed for the most part,
mm-hmm.
Which is an interesting detail, right? He is sacrificing Tyler at the beginning. Then he's sacrificing Johnny. And then he sacrifices himself, but always through other people. So he's selfish, right? He's a psychopath, you know? And then he kind of gets what's coming to him and pays the ultimate price, as they keep saying, you got to pay the price, you got to pay the price. It's the ultimate risk, all that kind of stuff. So to return to the fireside chat, what exactly is said that triggers Tyler's responses, right? They're macho assholes who have a death wish, which they do, and that she's saying there's too much testosterone. Well, honestly, chest-pumping egoism that effectively seems like the opposite from traditional heterosexual machismo seen in most other action movies. Spoiler alert, you don't need big balls to pull off these stunts, okay? We enter the scene with you drop down into the pit. It's 25 feet straight down, and your balls, man, your balls are about this big, expressed with the thumb and forefinger pinched to nothing. It's much better when you watch the movie. Next, we hear Roach, one of his crew. There's nothing that comes close to it, not even sex. For a Hollywood action blockbuster, these aren't typical lines uttered by a group of men describing the ultimate rush, with their multiplex brethren citing competition and Big Cojones energy as reigning supreme. You know, in short, this isn't a dick measuring contest, you know, for lack of a better word. Before the tense first skydiving scene, the crew, alongside a recently unmasked Utah, this is after the flamethrower scene for the viewer at home, the whole crew kind of teases the safety of his parachute pack. You know, they're kind of jerking him off, and here we go. Utah stops the jesting cold with, "We gonna jump or jerk off?" And then Bodhi's like, "That's my man," you know? And there's so much of that. There's that possession, and yep. There's that, you know, camaraderie and bromance, let's say, for the parlance of our times. But it is so layered and has its innuendos, surely. So more than slick talk between boys, these are sexually charged lines, you know, intentionally written and referring to male anatomy or lewd acts concerning such. Bigelow's adrenaline junkies believe surfing, skydiving, robbing are the mecca of being in oneness, that testing one's fate is far more pleasurable than testing one's sexual prowess. It simply can't be replicated. Forget sex, it's all about spirit, you know? As Bodhi recites with great reverence, surfing is about losing yourself and finding yourself. In Strange Days, Lenny also holds his main preoccupation with severe thoughtfulness, or at least creates a moral and philosophical code to excuse his conscience of his black market dealings. And just to FYI, Lenny is also an ex-cop, so another cop. You know, and the main villains in the movie are cops.
So. Bad guys. Real dirty cops.
The worst cops in the world. Basically the worst people ever. We have no...
They're like robots in that movie, though.
Well, they're like the Terminator. Yeah, Shirley Terminator-style guys. Absolutely. In his sales pitch to the attorney near the film's beginning, Lenny recites what's likely a well-worn script. "I can get you anything. I'm your priest. I'm your shrink. I'm your connection to the switchboard of the souls." Soul, spirit, think about it, all right? "I'm the magic man, the Santa Claus of the subconscious."
Such a good line.
It's a great line. Thank you, Jimmy C., for that one. Here, surfing could still be someone's ultimate rush. So in Strange Days, imagine someone getting a surfing clip and inserting it into their squid, and maybe they too can't run or something, but they can go surfing, right? It's not far-fetched. You can do whatever you want. Basically, you can get whatever you want with this technology. So imagine surfing as someone's ultimate rush through the squid, but a mediator exists in the cerebral capture born out of military technology gone illegal with squid, right? In one interview, Bigelow admits she and the screenwriting team, including James Cameron, imagine Lenny as a director, producer, writer himself. Whereas the filmed environment is much more controlled, certainly for Bigelow's brand and technique, as opposed to Lenny directing basically the porn he's shooting with the two females earlier on. She too provides an experiential hyperreal for the viewer. Again, that mediated image, as Lenny does for his clients. Filtered and compressed countless times by Bigelow's vision, her images are rendered realistic again, or at least replicate one version of reality. Whether it's skydiving with the ex-presidents in Point Break or witnessing the assassination of Jericho 1 in Strange Days, which again is a movie clip that someone is watching and experiencing, right? It is a triple or third layer degree of removal from us to the reality of the assassination of Jericho 1. So there's the captured image from Bigelow, the camera, the actual actors. Then someone would have had to put that on a clip. So then it becomes a physical media, with a diegetic physical media within it. Someone is watching that, and then that clip, the second degree, is then placed on a DVD and we are watching that, okay? Just wrap crazy. All your head in that. It's so important and it's so potent, because really, how are those things now shared? It's a little bit more ephemeral, right? But think of the riots in 2020, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's really important, like just all passed down, you know, the surveillance technology, using your phones, the prevalence, the ubiquity of those cameras that we hold in our pockets, the ability to hold clips and images and upload that onto the cloud and view extremely depressing because of their direct relation, the exact same visuals, just ghost images and recreations from the film into the police brutality against black men now, right? So Rodney King to now, it's the same, but the mediated image, she understands that people would have watched it on their TV news network, that right. They wouldn't have experienced it firsthand, right? And it's the exact same experience that Mace is experiencing as a black woman in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So it's replicating reality and it's recreating a new reality. And I think with that, she understands how powerful it can be. Anyway, the mediated image, just very important to hold on. And that's what she's, you know, doing that, right? So it's Bigelow's careful recreation and manipulation of the moving image that folds in on itself in Strange Days, where Ray finds his protagonist deals in clips that would snugly fit in any other Bigelow film, really. She's almost self-referential here. And just like Bodhi's Ultimate Rush, Squid clearly provides its users and abusers with something better than the real thing, unless it's reused memories in Lenny's case with ex-boo Faith, and think of Faith effectively losing, or not Faith, think of Lenny and how he must effectively lose Faith in order to gain Faith back again in himself and others. Though we hardly get to know its use for old-fashioned thrills, like skydiving or surfing, Strange Days' voyeuristic brain recording technology provides a useful analog for filmmaking and film going, as conspicuous recreations of reality can affect the brain too much, wherein reality replicated becomes the hyper-real reality for the viewer. Again, think of the Rodney King, think of this. These echoes and refractions, spectral hauntings of images seen before and tragedies witnessed and horror witnessed and then recreated on the film screen. Both Point Break and Strange Days are meta exercises with infinite refractions dealing in ubiquitous images and imaginings of traditionally accepted and celebrated forms of masculinity, such as crime and violence in big budget action fare. How these two examples deconstruct and reshape on-screen manhood has everything to do with Bigelow's painterly construction of the moving image, since the director inherently knows her images are constantly negotiated with on the viewer's part, and there's a reciprocity of understanding and meaning between image and viewer. In large part, this is represented by Bigelow's platonic ideal, as I've been saying, the pure unmediated image, but understanding that it will be mediated in the end and kind of playing with that very smartly. She is a semiotician. She tries to render an image as close to reality as possible. Therein lies her filmography's meta-narrative, if we can say, as each feature constitutes a new repertoire in recreated images. You're watching Zero Dark Thirty, you just thought of Hurt Locker. You know, you're thinking of Strange Days, you just thought of Point Break. She understands that. She understands when you're watching Spielberg movie, you're comparing it to every other Spielberg movie and then every other movie ever made. You know,
yeah.
everything is context. Everything is so important. And that's part of it. You're watching a movie and you're dissecting it and you're thinking of all the other movies that you've dissected. And then you're thinking of the news that you're watching, and people just kind of forget that, and some of the lesser movies that recreate such and such things. West Side Story being remade because it's like, well, let's talk about gentrification and let's have a more accurate representation of Puerto Ricans on screen versus the original, right? Just as a Spielberg example, right? You know, yeah. What I mean?
Mm-hmm. There it is.
Okay, I think that's going to pretty much wrap up this episode. Loaded with so many good ideas and definitely, you know, bring everything you can to these movies when you watch them. Bigelow's such a great director. So, yeah, I think that's going to be everything from us.
Until next time.
Okay, bye.